Welcome to the A-Level Religious Studies Revision Podcast. I'm your tutor for today, and in the next 10 minutes, we're going to cover one of the most intellectually rich and rewarding topics on the EdExcel specification, Islamic ethics and moral principles. Whether you're sitting paper 9, RS04C for the first time, or doing a final revision sprint, this episode is going to give you the concepts, the scholars, the exam technique, and the confidence you need. So let's get started. First, a quick word on why this topic matters. Islamic ethics is not just an abstract philosophical discussion. It is a living, breathing, legal, and moral tradition that has shaped the lives of over 1.5 billion people for more than 14 centuries. When examiners set questions on this topic, they are asking you to engage with that tradition seriously, to show you understand its internal logic, its tensions, and its ongoing relevance. Candidates who score in the top band do not just describe Islamic ethics, they evaluate it. They argue, they use scholars, they reach a genuine judgment. That is what we are going to help you do today. Now let's move into the core concepts. And we are going to start with the most fundamental distinction on the entire specification, the difference between Sharia and fiqh. Sharia literally means the path to the watering hole. It refers to the divine, immutable law revealed by Allah. It is perfect, eternal, and unchanging. Fiqh, on the other hand, means deep understanding. It is the human attempt to interpret and apply Sharia in specific contexts. Fiqh is fallible. It can change. It varies between scholars and schools of thought. This distinction is absolutely critical for your exam. One of the most common mistakes candidates make, and examiners note this every year, is conflating the two. If you write Islam says X is forbidden without specifying which school of thought or which jurist's interpretation you are drawing on, you will lose marks. Always anchor your claims in fiqh, not in a vague appeal to Islam as if it speaks with one voice. Now, building on this, let's talk about usul fiqh, the four roots or sources of jurisprudence. Think of these as the toolkit that Islamic scholars use to derive ethical rulings. The first and most authoritative source is the Quran. It is the direct, revealed word of Allah, and any ruling derived from it carries the highest authority. The Quran contains around 500 verses with direct legal content, though the vast majority of the text is theological, narrative, and ethical guidance rather than specific legislation. The second source is the Sunnah, the recorded practices, sayings, and tacit approvals of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. These are preserved in collections called Hadith. The most authoritative Hadith collections are those of Bukhari and Muslim, compiled in the 9th century. The Sunnah is essential because the Quran often states a principle without specifying how to implement it. The Sunnah fills that gap. The third source is Aima, scholarly consensus. If the qualified scholars of the Muslim community reach agreement on a ruling, that consensus becomes binding. The classical jurist Al-Shafi'i, who founded the Shafi'i school of law in the 9th century, was instrumental in formalizing the role of Aima. He argued it provided a safeguard against individual error. The fourth source is Qiyas, analogical reasoning. This is where a jurist takes a ruling from the Quran or Sunnah and extends it to a new situation by identifying a shared underlying principle. The classic example used in textbooks is the prohibition of alcohol. The Quran prohibits wine, khamr, because it intoxicates and clouds the mind. By Qiyas, scholars extended this prohibition to all intoxicating substances, even those that did not exist in 7th century Arabia. The shared principle, the ilah, or effective cause, is intoxication itself. A helpful mnemonic for the four sources is QSIQ, Quran, Sunnah, Aima, Qiyas. Or you might remember it as quite serious Islamic questions, whatever sticks for you. Now let's move to the al-Aqam al-Khamsa, the five categories of ethical action. These are the backbone of Islamic moral reasoning, and you must be able to name, define, and apply all five. 1. Wajib, obligatory. Performing a wajib act is rewarded. Omitting it is punished. The five daily prayers are wajib. Fasting in Ramadan is wajib. 2. Mandab, recommended or praiseworthy. Performing a mandab act is rewarded, but omitting it carries no punishment. Giving voluntary charity beyond the obligatory zakat is mandab. 3. Mubah, permitted or neutral. Neither rewarded nor punished. Eating most foods falls into this category. 4. Makruh, discouraged or disliked. Omitting a makruh act is rewarded. Performing it is not punished, but it is considered undesirable. Divorce, while legally permitted, is described in some hadith as the most disliked of permitted things. making it makruh in many scholars' view. 5. Haram, forbidden. Performing a haram act is punished. Refraining from it is rewarded. Consuming alcohol and pork are haram. Murder is haram. Usury, riba, is haram. A mnemonic for the 5 categories. Wise Muslims might make headway. Wajib, mandab, mubah, makruh, haram. Write that on a sticky note. Now let's turn to one of the most philosophically rich debates on the specification, the tension between Asharite and Mu'tazilite ethics. This is where your AO2 evaluation marks really come from. The Asharites, named after the 10th century theologian Abu al-Hasan al-Ash'ari, hold a position very close to divine command theory. For the Asharites, an action is good because Allah commands it and bad because Allah forbids it. Goodness and badness are not independent properties that exist prior to God's will. They are constituted by God's command. This means human reason alone cannot determine what is morally right. We must rely on revelation. The Asharite position became the dominant view in Sunni Islam and remains so today. The Mu'tazilites, a rationalist theological school that flourished particularly in the 8th and 9th centuries, took a very different view. They argued that good and evil are objective, rational categories that exist independently of God's will. Human reason is capable of discerning moral truth without revelation. God, being perfectly rational, commands what is good because it is good, not the other way around. This position has obvious parallels with natural law theory in Western philosophy. For your evaluation, the key question is, which position is more persuasive? The Asharite view preserves divine sovereignty and avoids the implication that God is constrained by external moral standards. But it faces the Euthyphro dilemma. If something is good simply because God commands it, does that not make morality arbitrary? The Mu'tazilite view avoids this problem but risks subordinating God to an external, rational standard, which many theologians find theologically problematic. Use the scholar-counter-scholar method in your essays. Introduce the Asharite view. Cite al-Ash'ari or al-Ghazali. Then introduce the Mu'tazilite counterposition. Then bring in a modern scholar. Tariq Ramadan is excellent here. In his 2009 work, Radical Reform, Ramadan argues for a contextual, maqasid-based approach that transcends the classical Asharite-Mu'tazilite binary. He contends that Islamic ethics must engage with contemporary realities through renewed ijtihad, independent reasoning, rather than rigid taqlid, which means imitation of past rulings. Speaking of ijtihad and taqlid, these are the final conceptual pair you need to master. Ijtihad, from the Arabic root meaning to strive, refers to independent legal reasoning by a qualified scholar to derive a ruling on a new question. Classical scholars set very high bars for who could perform ijtihad: mastery of Arabic, the Quran, the Sunnah, A'immah, and Qiyas. By the 10th century, many Sunni scholars declared the closing of the gate of ijtihad, meaning that the major legal questions had been settled and future scholars should follow established rulings through taqlid. This is a contested claim. Many modern scholars, including Ramadan, argue the gate was never truly closed and that renewed ijtihad is essential for Islamic ethics to address contemporary issues like bioethics, environmental ethics, and financial systems. Taqlid, imitation or following, means adhering to the rulings of an established madhab or school of law. The 4 main Sunni madhabs are the Hanafi, Maliki, Shafi'i, and Hanbali schools, each named after their founding jurist. Taqlid provides consistency and accessibility for ordinary Muslims who are not qualified jurists. Critics argue it can lead to stagnation. And finally, let's briefly cover Maqasid al-Sharia, the higher objectives of Islamic law. Al-Ghazali, the 11th century scholar, and later al-Shatibi in the 14th century, identified 5 essential objectives that Islamic law is designed to protect: the preservation of faith, life, intellect, lineage, and property. These maqasid provide a teleological framework for Islamic ethics. Actions are evaluated not just by their textual basis, but by whether they serve or undermine these 5 objectives. This is a powerful tool for contemporary ethical reasoning. Right. Now let's talk exam technique, because knowing the content is only half the battle. For the 10-mark AO1 question, you have 15 minutes. The command words will be examine or clarify. Your job is breadth and depth. Define your key terms immediately. Do not assume the examiner knows you know what ijtihad means. Show them. Provide at least 2 developed examples. Aim for 3 paragraphs of substantive content plus a brief conclusion. For the 20-mark AO2 question, you have 30 minutes. The command words will be evaluate or assess. Your conclusion must be a genuine judgment, not a summary, but a verdict on which argument is more persuasive and why. Use the scholar-counter-scholar method. Introduce a position, cite a scholar, introduce a counterposition, cite another scholar, then synthesize. Examiners are looking for dialectical chains, not lists of viewpoints. Common mistakes to avoid. First, conflating Sharia and fiqh. We've covered this, but it bears repeating. Second, asserting a ruling is Islamic without specifying the madhab or source. Third, failing to distinguish between ibadah, acts of worship, and muamala, social transactions, when applying ethical categories. Fourth, in evaluation questions, simply presenting both sides without reaching a judgment. Examiners call this sitting on the fence, and it will cap your marks at level 3. Now, quickfire recall quiz, cover your notes and answer these out loud. Question 1. Name the 4 roots of Usul al-Fiqh. You have 10 seconds. The answers are Quran, Sunnah, Ima, Qiyas. Question 2. What are the 5 categories of al-Ahkam al-Khamsa? 10 seconds. Wajib, Mandab, Mubah, Makruh, Haram. Question 3. What is the key difference between the Asharite and Mu'tazilite positions on ethics? Asharites hold that goodness is defined by God's command, divine command theory. Mu'tazilites hold that good and evil are objective, rational categories knowable by reason. Question 4. What does ijtihad mean, and who argued for its renewal? Independent legal reasoning. Tariq Ramadan, in Radical Reform, published in 2009, argued for renewed ijtihad. Question 5. Name the 5 maqasid al-sharia. Faith, life, intellect, lineage, property. How did you do? If you struggled with any of those, go back and reread that section of your notes before your exam. To summarize today's episode, Islamic ethics is built on the foundational distinction between sharia, divine, immutable law, and fiqh, human, fallible interpretation. The 4 roots of usul al-fiqh, Quran, Sunnah, Aimah, and Qiyas, provide the methodology for deriving rulings. The al-Ahkam al-Khamsa classify all human actions on a spectrum from obligatory to forbidden. The Asharite and Mu'tazilite debate represents one of the deepest tensions in Islamic thought, and modern scholars like Tariq Ramadan are actively engaging with it. And the Maqasid al-Sharia provide a teleological framework that allows Islamic ethics to engage with contemporary challenges. Remember, in your exam, define your terms, cite your scholars, build dialectical chains, and reach a genuine judgment. You've got this. Good luck, and I'll see you in the next episode.